Yes. Now I want to get down to actually studying Shemot Rabbah itself. It's the Midrash devoted to the explanation, expansion of the story of our people's birth. And from an academic point of view, it has a certain fascination. Historical ideas that are introduced, and we'll discuss those. But for me, it has an additional fascination, and something I'd like you to try and do with me. You're looking at a text which shows how the Torah was being expounded for ordinary folk in the synagogues of the land of Israel 15, 16, 17, 1800 years ago. And that is the primary way in which we should view this. So what I'm going to ask you to do is imagine with me that you're sitting in one of those ancient synagogues and you're hearing the rabbi expound the text. And he's doing it with a soul. He's doing it to make it lively, interesting. He's going to interpolate into it fresh strands of the narrative. He's going to elaborate on the narrative in an imaginative way. In some cases, you'll say, beyond my stretch of the imagination. But this was done to enliven these people. And you must remember that they were poor people, they were uneducated, and their one free afternoon in the week was Shabbat afternoon. They worked 6 days. And what did they do on Shabbat afternoon? They came back to the synagogue to hear the rabbi expound the text. You know, so therefore, he makes it entertaining.
It is an attaché rather than the actual davening.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. This was part of what we're looking at in the Midrash, comes to us not so much from the sermons, but from the way in which they were expounding the text to their congregants on a Shabbat afternoon. Because that was the primary learning time. For the majority of people, when else could they learn? You're out in the field at 6 o'clock in the morning, you don't come dragging in till 6 o'clock at night. There was no other opportunity to learn. So that Shabbat afternoon was learning time. And because Shabbat afternoon was learning time, the Uvolat Zion, which was meant to be said as an epilogue to learning, was transferred from the morning to Mincha.
Are we talking about Israel?
Yes, Israel.
Palestine.
Yes, we're talking about Israel because Midrash does not come from Babylon. Midrash is the product of the Holy Land. And our Midrash, Shemot Rabbah, the first 15 chapters, were compiled in the Holy Land 7th or 8th century. The book that we have called Shemot Rabbah is not one word. Somebody has tucked two halves together. But the first half, which is an actual Midrashic commentary, they call it an exegetical Midrash, that goes back to the land of Israel, 7th or 8th century. But the material it contains is a lot, lot older. So let's see what he gets up to. Story. Vayakom Melech Hadash, a new king arose. Ashelo Yadad Yosef, he didn't know Joseph. No, no, I haven't started reading the text yet. Because I'm just quoting verbatim from the Law of Moses. Where it says, a new king arose. What does that mean, a new king arose? How would you explain that? Even in modern terms, what does it mean? There was the old king died, a new king arose. That is not usually the language that the Bible uses. When it says an heir to the previous monarch, it usually says, Vayomer so-and-so, Vayimlach so-and-so beno tachtov. This king dies, and his son reigns in his place. So, Vayakom Melech Hadash is clearly not a successor to the preceding monarch.
New dynasty.
A new dynasty. Yeah, that would make the most sense of the text. And if it was a new dynasty, so how is it he doesn't know Joseph? This is a problem. Show your data. So what, no records? Or he didn't know him personally. I didn't have him around for tea. So how do I explain that comment? We cannot be sure. Just don't really know. But I'll remind you of something I've mentioned often before. That our new king may in fact have been the monarch as a result of a change in regime. Not just a new dynasty, but an actual change in regime. That the old regime was brought to an end, and now I'm looking at a king in a new regime. If so, does it fit in with history? It all depends on where and when you date the Exodus. And we've discussed this before, I only remind you. The usual dating for the Exodus is that it took place 12th century, 13th century. Why? Because it's assumed that the king of the oppression, the Pharaoh, was Ramses II. Why do we assume it's Ramses? Because they built a city called Ramses. There were several, but Ramses II was the greatest, the oldest, most powerful. He was, I think he was on the throne for about 90 years. Is that tenable? That's a real question. You see, that means the Exodus took place the latter part of the 13th century or the beginning of the 12th century BCE. That's the usual explanation. What's wrong with it? It doesn't fit in with biblical evidence. Now there's a problem. Why doesn't it fit in with biblical evidence? King Solomon completes his temple about the year 950 BCE. We don't know because he didn't, you know, there's no, we haven't discovered the foundation stone. But 950 BCE is a good estimated guess. It's a guesstimate. And the Book of Kings makes a point of telling us that King Solomon completed the temple 480 years after the Exodus from Egypt. Now, mathematicians, please add 480 to 950, and what do you end up with? 1430. That ain't the 12th century. Well, maybe that's an error, you know. God forbid we should accuse it, but that's such a neat figure, it probably isn't correct. But then you get the story of Yiftach, poor old Yiftach, who finds himself as a ruler, he's the judge. No sooner he's in position, he has to deal with the Ammonites. And the Ammonites are a pain, they are a serious threat for the whole nation of Israel. Although at that time there is no nation, it's just 12 independent, rather horrible tribes. And they come up against Yiftach with their armies, and he says, what do you want from me? What do you want from me? You've taken our land. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? He said, look, we've been here 300 years. You haven't challenged us. Now, Yiftach is a judge, probably 11th century BCE, maybe a little earlier, can't be sure. But add 300 years to that, where do you end up in? 15th century BCE again. So it's a little bit too much of coincidence to say that the Exodus was 12th century, when you can see there's biblical evidence to suggest it was much earlier. Much earlier. And that the period of the judges was in fact longer than you thought. Otherwise, I find myself at the period of the judges extending, if I put Joshua 1150 BCE and Saul is 1000 BCE, I've only got 150 years of the judges. No, it wasn't. It was 300 to 400 years of the period of the judges.
Can I just mention?
Yeah, sure.
The latest researchers and writers on the subject, yes, suggest that Ramses was a contemporary of Solomon.
Oh, the dating and redating and updating and downdating. It's an interesting game. It depends what fragment of a chamber pot you'll find next on which to base your latest theory. We don't really know. There are no complete records. In fact, the most complete record coming to us from the period is the Bible itself. Everything else is highly fragmentary. And you've got Finkelstein in Israel, this professor at Tel Aviv, who regards the whole of the Bible, the whole of the biblical history as nonsense. There was no... If there was a David, he never really existed, and Solomon never built a temple, and Jerusalem is never anything more than a village. You ever heard him go on television? All the goyim love it. the dating, if I put it back into the 15th century BCE, becomes that much more significant. Why? Because it is in the 15th century BCE that the regime of the Hyksos, the Semitic rulers of Egypt, is brought to an end. 200 years there were Semitic rulers in Egypt, known as the Hyksos. They were driven out, and a native monarch was set up, Thothmes III, and established, therefore, a regime of Egyptian kings, having expelled the foreign invaders. Now, could that be by Yaakov Melech Hadash, and there arose a new king? I can't answer emphatically yes. I can only say, is it possible? Okay, we'll allow for the possibility. Point number two. If I have had a revolution and the Semitic rulers have been booted out, I haven't got rid of all my Sivites, have I? I've got a whole bunch of them, several hundred thousand, maybe more than a million Semites living in Goshen. Now, they had first come there at the invitation of an earlier pharaoh, who probably himself may have been a Semite. And they've lived there, and they've grown there, and they've flourished there. But I now have a regime which has good reason to be hostile towards Semite.
Did you find Semite in
this? You say a million?
Yeah, I said maybe a million. 600,000 men come out. Apart from the women and the children.
I thought it was 3 million.
Funnily enough, more than a million could be 3 million. You know, even with my terrible mathematics.
The kids and the women, I mean.
Okay, yeah, well look, we don't know. The Bible tells us a figure, we have to accept it. But let's
do you find Semite in that time, in that context?
Of course. Semite is the word we use for a group of peoples who originate maybe in Mesopotamia, we're not sure. Could have been the Arabian Peninsula, we don't really know. But with clearly common language features, Akkadian, Aramaic, Hebrew, the Canaanite languages, the Arabic language, all sister languages, like much in the same way as you'd say French, Spanish, Portuguese, Italian, Romanian. They're a family. And here we can see a family of languages, and indeed we know that they are interrelated. The game of the Middle East, as we said so often, is that you get a northern power becoming the superpower and flooding down through Canaan and conquering parts of Egypt. And then you'll have a reversal where you've suddenly got a powerful pharaoh and he goes back up through Canaan and invades the northern Canaan. This was their political game. That was their superpower game. But imagine the situation, therefore. I now have an indigenous Egyptian monarch. He's a native monarch and he's got a bunch of Semites there. And what does he say about them?
They're a third
column. They're a fifth column. They're too many of them. Too many of them. I mean, he makes an assumption. Remember, he makes an assumption. Hayaki tikrena milchama. And if a war should break out, when no safkam, who else will name him? He'll be added to our enemy. Why do you make that assumption? And a nasty, suspicious mind. Now, he could have said that for one of two reasons. Reason number one, a new regime wants to focus the attention of his people somewhere else. So if I've got an alien group there, what better? I mean, that's been the story of the Jews for how long? We are the source of all problems, and that way you take your eyes off what the government's doing. Or alternatively, he has a genuine fear. We may be reinvaded by our Semitic enemies from the north. And if that happens, with whom will this bunch of Semites side? With us or them? So if it is a scare tactic, like all good scare tactics, it has to have more than a grain here. You know, you've got a cornfield. So that is how I would understand the biblical story from a modern standpoint. But I've got a new regime and a king who's anxious to either protect Israel or to protect his regime, whichever way you wish to look at it, and therefore views the Israelites as a potential threat. You might argue, why? Were they armed? No, they weren't armed. Were they in fact militaristic? Yeah, they were about as militaristic as a bunch of enraged sheep. They had no army, they had no structures, nothing. But it was a good enough reason to get them under control. The next point, of course, is how did they do that? And that's, once again, a subject of considerable discussion. How did the Egyptians enslave the Israelites? It doesn't say so. It says they made them work. And the medieval commentators hold differing views on this, and the most plausible is that which is offered by Rambam. And that is, when it says they set over them sore missing taskmasters, that is a mistranslation. What are sore missing? Tax inspectors. Mus is a tax. Noxim could be taskmasters. They are. Noges is the force, the push, to coerce.
Why from the patach to the hirik? That's
a matter of language. I can't go into that one. It has something to do with the development of the Semitic languages. It's not the only one. Okay, so let's view the possibility. What can this mean?
So it says, started off with tax inspectors.
Well, that's it. Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's all right. I'll complain later. How did it work? Says Rambam. Pharaoh says to the Israelites, you're living here. You have the benefit of living in our territory. Under the circumstances, you should be making a contribution to our economy. You should pay for the privilege. It's not unreasonable, is it? You have to pay. Only, I'm not asking for money. I want payment in kind. And what kind? You work for me. You must give me so many days a year of manual labour. And I will appoint over you officers who will assign to you your tasks.
Community service.
Yeah. Sure. Right? They are the Sarenisi. They are the guys. Now, we need so many people to work on this site, we need so many people to work on that site. Makes a lot of sense.
And of course, we say it was a bit gradual.
Well, see, that's the point. Once I've got them working in the field, I don't let them go. Then that's when my soldiers start appearing, and they are suddenly on the scene, and the guy with the whip turns up, and what may have started as a contribution to the society ends up as enslavement. Does that make sense? So far, so good. I mean, it's highly plausible. I can't prove it.
Well, I'd just like to introduce a note of caution. What was the condition of the Jewish population before this new, in what ultimately becomes an enslaving regime?
We have to make a very simple assumption. They were living a self-contained life, doing what they'd always done, as shepherds. They are nomads with their flocks that have settled in a particular region. And the only thing they had when they came from the land, they were shepherds when they left Mesopotamia, they were shepherds when they were in the land of Canaan, and they were shepherds when they were sitting there in Goshen. No, they didn't. They were self-contained. In fact, it is even questionable whether the majority of Israelites ever understood or spoke Egyptian.
Okay.
But if we were...
Why should, therefore, you this is a period of time, isn't it? This is quite a substantial period of time between the time, couple of hundred years, into a time for a people to become established, albeit in a restricted area, right?
Yeah.
And to, in those days, one could assume, accumulate a certain amount of wealth and whatever, and ownership of whatever. It's happened surely throughout history. It was in Poland, for example, how many Jews spoke Polish? Majority spoke Yiddish.
Absolutely.
And we've gone through, and yet people established and so isn't really what you're saying in history a motivational, a gradual process, thought out process to actually suppress a people over a period of time.
Can you move from being a pastoral people to an arable people?
It could well be. Were they assimilated? That's another question.
Rabbi, if we've sunk to the 49th depth of level of depravity, we must have mixed with them.
Well, clearly they infected us. clearly they infected us. But how do you know that we didn't bring a fair bit of it with us?
All over the world.
Right, how do you know? You know, if you look at the history of the Israelites, the land of Israel, they are morally, physically, economically corrupt. From top to bottom. Pardon? Well, no comment. Why do I say they may not have spoken Egyptian? There's a fleeting reference in a psalm that you may have seen before on a Thursday morning, where it says, when I pass through it, Sfat lo shamati, lo yadati eshma. I heard a language that I did not know. Because when they left Egypt, what did they have to do? They had to pass from Goshen through Egyptian territory to leave. And they saw the Egyptians burying their dead. And says the psalmist, at that time, they heard a language they didn't know. What does that mean? They were not using Egyptian. They were a self-contained entity. And you do get that. I mean, how before the 18th century, how self-contained were the Welsh or the Scots?
Their modus operandi changes because of the tax inspectors.
Well, what happens is, I suddenly come to able-bodied people saying, look, you are shepherd, Goshen was a beautiful part of the land, remember that. They were living in one of the best areas of Egypt.
Best pasture
land. So I can understand the king was saying, now look, you've got it good there, it's time you gave us something for it.
A bit like Zimbabwe. I'm not being funny. I'm not being funny, it's a bit like Zimbabwe. Right. A new people for them went, accumulated wealth, went with money, accumulated land, whatever it is, didn't speak the language. Right?
The whites. Your psalm for the moment on Thursday.
Yeah.
Could it be that is an anachronistic reference? That in fact the psalmist himself presupposed that that had been the case, rather than it was anything other than that.
Well, on another occasion, not now obviously, but perhaps when we finish what we're doing, we'll look at that psalm again. Right, so perhaps you'll form another opinion. Right, so look how, from trying to piece together the real history, look how we're challenged, how much we just don't know. The rabbis have a different approach.
Well, the Egyptians have been paying income tax, and this is an additional. I mean,
peoples have been taxed by their rulers. I'm demanding something special from you because you're aliens. You're resident aliens. Imagine if they did that today. What would Lord Ahmed say if we did that?
Rabbi, surely the historic basis for taxation was either kind or labour.
No, people gave money as well.
Well, I'm saying kind or labour, money or
yeah, sure.
Or
and labour was a very common. King Solomon does it. Thing. King Solomon imposes a tax of labour upon the local people.
We know it's not unknown.
It's not perfectly legit. Now, as I say, the rabbi's approach is very different. They're not concerned with history. They manipulate and use history. But they assume the biblical story contains the basic facts. And we have traditions regarding additional information. And where I don't have the traditions, I've got plenty of imagination. So let's have a look at passage one there. Rabbanan Amrei, the rabbis asked, Lama Kariu Melech Mitzrayim Melech Chadash? Why did they call him a new king? Vahalo Paro Atzmo Haya, it was the same old Pharaoh. Now that's something, you see, we hadn't even thought about. We said it's either a new king who succeeded to his father, or it's a new regime. One of the rabbinic views is there was no new king, it was the same old Pharaoh. The same old Pharaoh we've been looking at all the time. So why did they call him a new king? Ela sha'amru ha'mitzrim lefaro. But the Egyptians said to Pharaoh, Bo v'nizdaveg le'umazo. Come on, let's attack this people. Amalahem, he said to them, Shotim, idiots, ad achshav mishalahem anu oklim. Until now we've been living off their benefit. V'yach nizdaveg, how can we attack them? Ilule Yosef, were it not for Joseph, lo haya lanu chayim, we wouldn't be alive now.
Here is a man who
didn't
know Joseph.
Clearly.
He didn't
know Joseph. Kivan shelo shamalahem, and since they wouldn't listen to them, horiduhu mikiso gimu chadashim, they deposed him for 3 months. Ad she'amalahem, until he conceded and said to them, kol ma she'atem rotzim hareini machem, whatever you want to do, I'm with you. Heshivu oto, so they restored him to his throne. V'ficha katav v'yakum melech hadash, there arose a new king. A king who was restored to his throne with a new policy.
A new government.
New government, yeah. But notice the implication. If you look at the biblical story, who's the Rasha? Who's the wicked man? Who is doing all the dirty work? Pharaoh.
Was the king
Yeah, well, amazing. But first of all, I don't take this as literal. You know, I'm taking it on its face value, not as a record of history. But notice something else. You see, one of the problems about the story in Shemot, and it is a real problem, is that the plagues are brought not on Pharaoh, they're brought upon the people of Egypt. And had the BBC been around at the time, they would have accused the God of Israel of using disproportionate force against a helpless, invasive population. Would that not be true?
Whereabouts was Goshen?
Goshen was
not far from Gaza.
No, yeah, not far. Nile Delta. Nile Delta. You see, the Egyptian people are on the receiving end of the worst effects of the flood, of the plagues. It's their cattle that's being killed. They're suffering from the diseases. They're dying. Their firstborn get killed. Now, is there any justice in that?
Absolutely. We go back to
No, but is there any justice in that?
Absolutely.
Well, pardon?
Absolutely.
Yes, of course there is. If you look very carefully at this biblical text, we need people who are familiar with the biblical story. It says, "Vayavidu Mitzrayim et bnei Yisrael v'farech." The Egyptians made the Israelites work with a finger, not just Pharaoh. The biblical text indicates that there was full collaboration on behalf of the Egyptian people. And the Midrash says, more than collaboration, they instigated it. Pharaoh was quite pragmatic. you know, we've done very well with this lot, so that thing ain't broken, go fix it. And it is people who step in and say, let's attack them. Anti-Semitism rising, not from government, but from grassroots. And it's that grassroots anti-Semitism that can ultimately force the hand of government.
Civil unrest is not a new thing.
It happened every time.
Isn't it an interesting imagery being used
wasn't
here?
Wasn't St. John Chrysostom an Egyptian?
I don't know. He may have been.
I think he was.
Could have been. Yeah. Listen, anti-Semitism in classical times, even it originates in Egypt.
They were despised nation anyway.
This is why I asked the question.
Yeah, it originates in Egypt.
Yeah, they were a despised nation anyway because they were shepherds and shepherds.
Well, yes, that's true. They would certainly have been shunned. They would have been regarded as the untouchable. But since they're leaving their own lives, so what? But this is
nothing,
not...
Enough for a long time, the answer is nothing at all.
Yeah.
Until things started to go wrong.
Well,
we don't... Wants money, for example. You know,
well, we don't know what went wrong. What we do know is that there is an assault made upon the Israelites. You could have given me the obvious answer, and that answer is going to be apparent in the next paragraph. Rabbanan patchela pitchala hai parashata. The rabbis used the following opening address to our parasha, to our sidra. Now, what do you mean following address? If you'd have gone into the synagogues of the ancient times, into the land of Israel, I don't know about Babylon, but certainly in the land of Israel. The weekly reading of the law began with a sermonette. A sermonette. A little hakdamah, known as a peticha, an opener. The rabbi would get up and he would take a verse, usually from the third section of the Bible, talking, but occasionally from the prophets, and expound that verse with relationship to the reading of the law for that morning. It was known as a peticha, an opener. We have several thousand of them in the Russian literature, so we know what they are, we know what they're like. They're very short. Some of you might argue Halevite were the same today. And here you're going to see this little sermon, but it's got a message. And they usually did have quite a meaty message. Bashem Bagadu, says the prophet Hosea. They have rebelled, dealt treacherously with the Lord. Ki banim zarim yaladu, for they gave birth to alien children. Ata yochle mechodesh et chelkehem, now shall the new moon consume their lot, whatever that means. We'll see what the Midrash does with it. Pardon? Ah, but you see, prophets are harking back to ancient times, according to the Midrash. The Lamedcha, this teaches us, Keshemet Yosef, when Joseph died, Heferu Berit Milah, the Israelites discontinued the practice of circumcision, or even worse, destroyed their circumcision. They underwent a very painful operation which created a false foreskin. We'll talk about that in a moment. Amru, they said, let's be like the Egyptians. Let's assimilate. After all, that's the perfect solution to anti-Semitism, isn't it? You lied with the wallpaper, they won't notice you and they won't hate you. That was the biggest myth of the 19th century. Mikan atalameid, from this you may infer, Shemoshe malan bitziatam mitzrayim, that when they left Egypt, Moses had to circumcise them. V'chivan sha'asukach, and because they did this, hafacha kadosh baruch hu ava shayu amitzriyim olimotam l'sina. God converted the affection which the Egyptians had for them up till that time into hatred.
May I ask a question here? I thought it was Joshua who did the circumcision.
Well, he's now made an inference that it was Moses. You see, this is where the Midrash plays its own game. But look what he says here. Because of the desire of the Israelites to assimilate, God aroused the hatred of the local population towards them. Isn't that ominous? You know, this is being said 1700 years ago, long, long before the European situation, but history fulfilled that. The more you try to assimilate, the more you say, I want to be like you, the more the chances they'll turn around and say, bloody Jew, you're not one of us. Who asked you to push yourselves into our professions, our universities, our banking, our newspapers? If you retain your Jewish personality, they'll persecute you. But if you start pushing yourself into their society, they may eliminate you. No, sad, so solemn thought. And that's what he's saying. That what brought about the change in attitude of the Egyptians towards the Israelites? Our desire to assimilate with them.
When is this writer living?
He's anywhere, the rabbis speaking here are anywhere between the 2nd and the 5th century we've come to.
Are you suggesting that, quite three centuries or more, that assimilation was a problem, that this was a miraculous?
No, I think that there is another lesson here. There is another lesson, partly so. But the rabbis of the Talmudic age were haunted by a reality. When they talk about destroying the circumcision, this is not a figment of imagination. If it was, it was a very painful one. This is precisely what occurred in the last two pre-Christian centuries, when as a result of the Hellenization of the ruling classes of the Jews, their desire to assimilate. What did they do? Young men who wanted to disport themselves in the gymnasium, in the nude, they underwent the operation to remove their circumcision. They were known as the Mayfair Brit, those who destroy the covenant.
Very difficult. It takes years. I believe I read some American Jewish people tried, mostly in the States, tried to reverse.
Apparently a very painful, very dangerous and all the rest of it, but they did it. They underwent this terrible operation and as a desire to assimilate. Now this tendency didn't end. Assimilation continued, whether it was physical or just intellectual. The Sadducees were assimilated. And certainly among the Jews living in the Mediterranean, outside the land of Israel, assimilation was extreme. And so our rabbis here are wagging a warning finger. If you try to alter yourselves to be like them, if you will turn your back on being an Israelite or being a Jew, it will fail. And contemporary history proved it. Look at the next one. Hava nitchak malo. Here's a nice piece of midrashic midrash. For those of you who know Hebrew language, as you do, a people is singular. It's a collective noun. So I can refer to the people in the singular. Lo. Let us deal cleverly. We will translate it with them. But in reality, literally it is with him, because is a singular. But for the rabbis, this cannot be. Lahem lo ne'emah el lo. So that it does not say, let us deal cleverly with them, the Israelites, but with him. Amar Rabbi Chama bar Chanina, Rabbi Chama bar Chanina said, Amru, the Egyptians said, Bo v'nitchakem le'lohehem shaleilu. Let's be clever with the God of this lot. Im nidonim b'cherev, if they are condemned to the sword, the Israelites, Kativ, it is written, Ki va'esh Hashem nishpat, the Lord will contend with fire, uvacharbo, and with his sword, et kol basar, against all flesh. So if we put his people to the sword, he'll come upon us with his sword. So lo nadon otan ela b'mayim. Let's punish them with water. Shekavar nishba she'enu mevi mabul shelmaim, because he has already made an oath that he will never bring another flood into the world. Shneimar, as it says, ki me'noach zot li, asher nishbati me'avo me'noach od al haaretz. I have sworn that the waters of the flood shall never again pass over the earth. V'heim lo yadi'u, but the Egyptians didn't know. Shal kol ha'olameinu mevi. When God made that oath, he meant he wouldn't inundate the whole of the world anymore. That did not preclude him from bringing a flood on a single nation. Apart from which, in any event, Ba'aleihem einu maybe, he didn't bring a flood of water upon them. Aval heim ba'im v'noftim l'tocho, they came and fell in the water of their own will. God didn't drown them with a flood. They walked into the sea. Shneimar, as it says, Yagirehu al yedei cherev, he allured them to their destruction. Manat shu'alim yehiyu, because they behave like foxes. Hence, ki badavar she'ezadu aleihem, God dealt with them in the way that they had planned to do to the Israelites. Amar Rabbi Elazar said, Bikadeira shebishlu bar nitbashlu, in the pot they planned to cook other people's goose, their own goose was cooked. So there's your little moral there. Because this was intended to make them feel good, because what are you looking at? You're looking at Roman occupation, the Roman oppression, and he's saying, don't worry, just as God dealt with the Egyptians, he'll deal with this lot.
Question in the mind.
Yeah.
I can't immediately bring to mind the preceding verse in the Haggadah, which precedes Habanit Chakmado. Yes. I have a vague recollection of maybe.
Vayemapar Elamo. No, it's with the people of Israel. In the Ambanay Israel, Rav Yatsum Mimer. And it's used in the singular. In the Ambanay Israel, Rav, singular, Yatsum, singular. So Habanit Chakmado. No, the grammar of it's fine. It's just that the rabbis chose to understand it differently.
I thought there was a reference to Yaakov.
No, he's mentioned in the opening verses of the Siddur, yes. Right. But not at this point. Look at the next one. By Yaavidu, over the page, number 4. By Yaavidu Mitzrayim et Bnei Yisrael b'Faro. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel work. Befarech. What does befarech mean? With rigor. You know, it's a perfect example of translating a rather unusual Hebrew term with an unusual English term. What does parach mean? Parach means to break. They subjected them to back-breaking work. Yeah, to breaking point. And indeed they did. Rabbi Eliezer said, no. Split the word into two. Befer rach. They made them work with a soft mouth. They allured them into work. They didn't coerce them. They spoke nicely. And that's what I suggested, if you remember, at the outset. And they said, come, you work for us. Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachman said, Bifricha. They made them work. With back-breaking work. They subjected them to hard labor. And this is how they dealt with each Jew. Whatever tally of bricks they produced on the first day, they decreed that this is the number you shall produce every day. Now think of this. On the first day, the guy is fresh. He'll produce 100 bricks. Thereafter, his strength will diminish, his capacity will diminish, and they were saying, no way, you did 100 bricks on day one, thank you, we will demand 100 bricks from you for every day. No, sure.
No.
Yes, please.
No.
Yeah.
Still the same.
Pardon?
Still the same. Today.
Yeah, what were you set as your world? Yeah, but these guys were being, the way they were being treated, they were being beaten. They don't do that in industry today. And they made their life bitter with hard work. Well, hard work in itself is bouncing. How do they make their life bitter? If you made them work, if you put them to labour, where's the bitterness? He'll explain. That's one bitterness. Look what else he suggests. With mortar and bricks, all manner of work in the field, eight kol avodatam, all their work. Says the Midrash. Batzchila, they began by making them produce work with clay and bricks. Livasov, ultimately, b'chol avoda basadeh, they made them do all the work in the field. Livasov, and thereafter, eight kol avodatam, they made them do all manner of work, scrubbing the floors, cleaning the houses, every conceivable form of work was imposed upon the Israelites. They weren't just building cities. They were not just building cities. They were forced into every manner of labor. This is a prefiguration of the Nazis. Precisely what they did. They exploited their slave labor in everything. And that's what the Egyptians were doing. And I think that's very close in the literal meaning of the text.
Can you go back to the word it's a segment of the community. Presumably it's not everybody that's doing this. There are children, there are women, and presumably there's some kind of vibrant life going on.
We're going to come to that. You're going to have to, David, you'll see that you've anticipated something here which is not made plain in the biblical text, but the rabbis suss it out and make some very plausible comments along those lines. May not get to it this week, we'll get to it next week, but yes, there was a disruption of their lives, from not just for the men, but also the women and children. Originally, the women and children were not being used for slavery. It's the men. And then ultimately, they allure the women in too. But there is an effort on the part of Pharaoh to disrupt the family life of the Jew, to dehumanize them.
I must assume, I suppose, that there is not going, following the Torah, after the description of the various phases of the Torah, people will still be passing on the information. This is what they did. It went from generation, voice to voice, or mouth to mouth.
Oh, yeah, sure, oral tradition.
And oral tradition was saying to, and in the end, the rabbis put it into writing.
Well, there is let's put it this way, that the rabbis may have preserved ancient traditions is always the possibility of Midrash. But also, I think that they are sensing something within the text. And you should be aware of it. I don't want to give it away yet, because we say it in the Haggadah. Remember, Haggadah is one of our oldest Midrashim of the Exodus. And in the Haggadah, hard labor they made the women do. The gentle work that called for a woman's touch, like the sewing and the knitting, whatever else they had to do, which called for finesse, they made the men do. And of course, if they didn't do it properly, what did they do to them? So that's how we make their lives bitter. I will impose upon them the impossible and then punish them for not being able to do it properly. Quite a feat of the imagination.
And yeah, maybe, I'm assuming that is imagination.
I'm assuming it is, but who knows how close to the truth. Asher avdu bahem befarech, which they made them do befarech, Amar Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana. Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana said, Mode Rabbi Eliezer shechanya b'frikam. When Rabbi Eliezer heard this description, he agreed, my interpretation of the soft mouth is not correct. You're right. They made them work till they broke their backs. Look what comes next. Dalgazerot Gazar Lehim Paro. Pharaoh passed four decrees on them. Tchila Gazar Vitziva Lenoxim Shehu Dochakim Bahem Gadeshu Osim Schum Shalahem. First of all, he decreed that his taskmasters, his enforcement officers, should coerce them in order that they should produce the tally that they made on their first day. That meant shelo yahayu yeshenim vatehen. They wouldn't have the opportunity to go home and sleep in their homes. If I demand of you the same number of bricks every day, then I'm not going to allow you to go home till you finish. Vahayuchashuv lemata mipiria varivya, because he wanted to diminish their sexual contact. He wanted to prevent them having children. Amar, he said, mitoch ze einam olidim. If I coerce them to keep on the site all the time, they'll not have children.
But the young people would be able to produce 100 bricks, but the old people would be for them.
Work till they drop dead. Amru lahem hanoksim, that the enforcement officers said to the Israelites, im atem holchim lisham bevateichem, if you go home to sleep, ad she'anachnu meshalchim achareichem baboker, before we'll round you up in the morning, hayom holech l'sha'al ishtam, you'll lose a couple of hours, ve'ein atem mashlimim atzchum shelachem, you won't complete your tally of bricks. Therefore it says, v'hanoksim atzim lomar kalu ma'aseichem. The taskmasters were urging them, saying, finish your work to Vayom B'Yomo on your daily basis. So Vayu Yosheni Malaris, they couldn't go home. They had to lie down on the ground where they were working and sleep. Amar Elohim, God said, Ani Amarti La Abraham Avihem. I said to Abraham, their father, Sha'ani Marbet B'nei Banav Kavim, that I would multiply his descendants like the stars of the heavens. Shnei Maz, it says, Ki beiracha varecha, but I will surely bless you, v'har ba'al be'et zaracha kokra shomayim, and I shall cause you to multiply like the stars of the heavens. V'atem mitchachamim lahem shelo yibu, and you're playing games to make sure that they will not increase? Nire eze davar omed, sheli o shelachem, we shall see whose plan will be fulfilled, yours or mine. And therefore, miyad, what does it say in the Torah? V'chashe yanu oto, kein yirbe v'chein yifrat. The more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied.
How do we explain that?
Well, you're going to get that in the next passage. But please notice something here, because you know I want this to register on you. Look at the verse. V'chasheyanu oto, the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied. What does that tell you about the affliction that they were imposing upon them?
It doesn't work.
No, but the affliction was intended to do what? No, to reduce their population. Hence he says, the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied. Now, that's the Peshat, only until you see the Midrash, you don't realize that's what he's saying. That is the Peshat, that is the plain meaning of the text. But you should have known this from the Haggadah. Vayaret on Yenu, he saw our affliction, says the Haggadah, Zo Prishut Derech Eretz. This was the interference in their family life. They tried to prevent them from having children. Remember that from the Haggadah? Now you can see where it's coming from. What does it mean? It's about how did... Sorry.
You're finding how nothing changes. I'm thinking that in the Far East, Stephen's day, or well, after 10 years ago, people came down from the village. They were put up in houses, in dormitory blocks, and they worked there.
Yeah.
18 hours a day.
Yeah.
And were allowed home. And when they got it, the idea was that they would in fact be controlled, that they wouldn't have children.
That would
they went home, and every time they went home, they had another child.
Yeah, which is self-defeating.
Trusted accountants know that.
Yeah. It's quite one thing strikes me.
Yeah.
If I can understand subjecting the purpose of subjecting a people to slavery, and you're getting a situation where you've got long-term servants.
Yeah.
This was short-termism. Once they didn't have children, their good life would go.
Well, this therefore...
This was short-termism.
This therefore goes back to the original point. Why was Pharaoh doing this to the Egyptians, to the Israelites? He was achieving two ends. Number one, he's eliminating them, but whilst I'm eliminating you, I'll get something out of you.
Yes.
The Nazis?
Same principle.
Same principle. I'm going to get rid of you, but whilst I'm getting rid of you, I'll get something out of you.
Will you give the slave labor? Sure.
And you can see, here is your role model, your prototype. I often make the point, the Egyptians were the first Nazis.
That was before the Vansay.
That's right, long before. Long before.
I just wonder if in fact the exemplar for these Midrashim, which are, as you said, 4th century onwards, was not Egypt but Rome.
Well, I should think that the Roman model was there, but the Romans did not systematically enslave people in quite the same way. The Jewish people under Roman rule could have lived quite happily if they hadn't misbehaved themselves and got het up with their ideas of messianism and kick out Caesar. Nobody was interfering. Pay your taxes like everybody else. Simple enough. But once they got up the Roman nose, that's when they began to get it.
You see, that's what they did. And I guess, that was their model. That was their model.
Could be. I won't elaborate. Let's begin the next paragraph because it's Rabbi Akiva. One of the most famous of the Agadis, the man with the great imagination. But what he says here is very touching, very moving, and maybe not so much imagination. Darash Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva says, Bischa nashim sitkaniot shahayu b'oto hador, because of the righteous women in that generation, nigalu Yisrael mitzrayim. Israel was redeemed from Egypt. The women were the cause of our redemption. And in fact, this is indicated in the biblical text. Because when the men were being enslaved and doing what they were told, who wouldn't obey Pharaoh? The Hebrew midwife. I mean, that was a brilliant move on this part. I want to dehumanize these people, so I'll prevent them from having marital relationships. I want to dehumanize them. I'll make them not trust one another. Very clever ploy. And where's the most sensitive area of trust? When it comes to the maternity wards. But if they'll suspect that their midwives are killing their children, well, I'm breaking down here. And they won't do it. Do your darndest, we're not doing it. And of course, that was one way in which Pharaoh would keep the hands of his soldiers clean. My soldiers won't do the dirty work. The Jews can do it to themselves. Capos. Okay? But the parallels are quite frightening, actually. I'm not inventing them. Look at how it goes on. Me'asu, what did they do? B'shar shahayu holochot lishov mayin, when the women used to draw water for the men, HaKadosh Baruch Hu mezamnu lehen dagim katanim b'chadehem, God prepared for them little fishes in their buckets, so that half the bucket was fish, half was water. Uvaot, and they came, shoftot shteka deirot, and set on two pots. Shofat means to set on a pot, you find it in the Bible. Achat shel dagim, one with fish, vachat shel chamin, and one for hot water. Umelichot etzel baalehen lesader, and they would come out to their husbands working in the fields. Umarchitzot otam, and they would bathe them with the hot water. Vesachot otam, and anoint them. Umarchilot otam, and they would give them to eat. And of course, this was foreplay. They massage them, they feed them, and where was it all leading? And between the furrows, they would lie down and have their family relationship. They thwarted Pharaoh. You wouldn't let them come home for it, so we'll come out into the field for it. And what is more, we will make our husbands relax, and we'll make them feel good. Shneemaz, it says, in Tishkavun ben Shvatayim, if you will lie down between the furrows, Kanfe Yona Nechpa Bakesef, wings of a dove covered in silver. Now that's the text. The Midrash is going to do something with it. Bizchut im Tishkavun ben Shvatayim, because of your efforts to lie with your husbands between the folds, Kanfe Yona, Kanfe Bakesef, you're going to have, I'm sorry, Zachu Yisrael, the mitzvot filin, shanasu kanfe yona. The Israelites were given the commandment of tefillin, which became dove's wings. Zachu leviza hayam, and they were entitled, they had the merit of all the spoils of the Egyptians lying by the Red Sea. Shneemaz, it says, Kanfe Yona, your women earned you the wings of a dove, Nechva Bachesev, and that you should be covered in silver. It's a lovely piece of Midrash. What's he talking about? Okay, the second half, that they took the spoils of the Egyptians, I don't know. What's this business of the wings of a dove being the tefillin? This is a story in the days of the Hadrianic persecution, where there was a scholar called Rabbi Elisha Baal Kanafai. He defied the Romans and put his tefillin on. And so they pursued him. And he took his tefillin off and was holding them in his hand. And they said to him, what have you got there? And he said, I have a dove. And they forced him to open his hand, and the tefillin turned into a dove and flew away. That's the story! That's the story. You know, what can one do with the story? You just listen to it.
Maybe he didn't have a dove.
Yeah, maybe he didn't have a dove. Yep, okay. What is the message? That the behavior of the women brought protection to the Israelites and wealth. Because they were prepared to defy Pharaoh. The men worked, the women defied. But I find this little description of how they came out into the fields and they bathed their husbands and gave them to eat. Very sensitive. You know, it's this borders, as it were, on the sensual. But the rabbis weren't afraid of these things. You know, they didn't live in a world that regarded this as something you don't talk about.
Before the nine o'clock.
What was the time limit or gap between Akiva and Hadrian? Because he was obviously aware of this.
Hadrian was responsible for Akiva's death. He was the man who was one of the leaders of the revolt against Hadrian and one of the leaders of the defiance of Hadrian's decree.
So this reference to the dove
is... Oh, yeah, for him, yes, sure. Contemporary. Yeah. Gentlemen, do you find this a useful exercise?
Brilliant.
Really enjoyable.